Riley presiding.
Good morning, and you may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're really happy to be back in person. You can see that we've made some accommodations. You each can argue from your own podium if you want, or you can use the middle one. The middle one goes up and down if you want to adjust it that way. These arguments are being recorded and will be posted on our website within a day or two. Please state your name for the record when you begin your argument and state which party you are representing. And so with that, our first case is McFarland versus McFarland. It's A21-1741. And attorney for appellant, are you ready to begin?
May it please the court, my name is Michelle Keel and I represent the appellant, Kimberly McFarland. The first issue before the court today is spousal maintenance and the trial court's award of $2,000 a month in permanent spousal maintenance to a husband who is healthy, relatively young, and well-educated should be reversed. It should be reversed first and foremost because there's been no finding of need. That's a threshold requirement under the statute that there must be a finding that he is in need of maintenance, and in fact, the court here found the opposite. It states that the parties have living expenses they are able to meet with their current incomes.
Talk about that. It was, the court seemed to use gross income, which for a husband was in monthly $66,657. There's evidence in the record that his net income was $3,927, and then his paycheck stubs, also in the record, showed it was a little over $4,000. What do we do with those different numbers? Because if you use net or paycheck stubs, then he doesn't have enough money to cover his monthly expenses, which the court found to be $5,500.
Well, a couple of points in response to that. First, it's husband's burden to show that he is in need of maintenance. And so it's his burden to show what his net income is. And the trial court specifically states it's not relying on his expert net monthly cash flow report.
Well, the district court did not say it's not relying on it. It said, there's some confusion there in terms, it's not crystal clear. But husband did produce those materials, and those materials are in the record, and it's pretty clear that the district court talked about and referenced gross income, but it's net income that is the key, and that is in the record. So why can't we rely on that? Why can't we look at it, and because the district court went to the second step, assume that the district court impliedly found that there was, in fact, need based on his net income of roughly $4,000?
Well, I think it would be wrong to conclude that the court impliedly found that he's in need when it's explicitly saying things like the parties have expenses they're able to meet with their income. If the court does go to net income, there's evidence in the record that he's still able to meet his expenses.
How can you do that when your net income is $4,000 and your adjusted expenses based on the district court are roughly $5,500?
Because the trial court failed to reduce his $55,000 expenses.
I understand your argument that you had in your reply brief on reducing it, but that's not what the district court found. The district court actually reduced it down to $5,500, and we have to look at what the district court did and whether the record supports that.
Well, but the record doesn't support the $5,500 that the trial court found to be his monthly budget. I mean, some of the items that we've identified are clearly not supposed to be included in the budget, and in fact, husband's actually acknowledged that. In his proposed order, paragraph 109, he acknowledges that, for example, the $237 of child support should not have been included in his budget. So it's clear error for the trial court to include that in the $5,500. Same with the car payment. He acknowledges he's not incurring a car payment right now. He was awarded a car that has very few miles on it. It's in good shape. He has no intention of replacing it. So those items should have been reduced from the $5,500. In addition to his excess savings and his retirement contribution. And once you do that, his expenses are $4,407. It's less than his monthly net income.
It's still more than his monthly net income, even with all the calculations that the district court should have taken into account.
Well, but the district court failed to include his investment income from the sale of the sale proceeds from the marital home as well. So he gets another $684 a month in income from that. And then he has an obligation to invest prudently the property that he's been awarded, and the trial court has an obligation to consider that income. And once you do that, he's actually running a surplus of about $500 a month. So there is no need for maintenance here.
Well, it seems that underlying the district court's order were the two factors. And one was the standard of living that they enjoyed during their marriage. And then the second one is that he was out of the workforce for, I think, 14 years while he took care of the kids and maintained the home, and she was able to move and promote her own career. So aren't those important things for district court judges to look at when they're deciding things like maintenance?
So those are only two factors, and as to the standard of living factor, the court doesn't identify, you know, any items that he doesn't have currently under his monthly budget that
the
they enjoyed.
Is a lot different. Living circumstances are a lot different. Presumably the kids had bedrooms with closets, for instance.
Well, I mean, the trial court reduced his budget for housing, which suggests he thinks the housing is excessive. So I mean, it's his burden to show a need for maintenance, and so the court can't just assume that there might be other expenses that he could incur to meet the standard of living. It's his burden to show what those expenses in accordance with the standard of living are. And to the extent the trial court just assumed that there must be other expenses, that's error. You know, in addition, you're right that the court repeatedly refers to the fact that he was out of the workforce for a period of time. But that alone is not sufficient to have an award of maintenance when he's meeting his monthly expenses with his income.
Well, but you're conflating the two arguments, and the argument here is on the second, not the first factor of the need, but whether or not the statutory factors are met. And the district court went through and analyzed each and every single one. So, I mean, it seems like the record supports the district court's analysis of those factors.
Well, although the trial court, you know, lists the factors and nominally goes through them, if you look at what the trial court says in relation to each factor, it's really going back to the same two things. It's going back to the fact that he was out of the workforce and wife currently makes more money than him. It says that in nearly every factor, even when it's really not relevant to the factor that it's supposed to be discussing. And that alone, again, is not sufficient for maintenance. It doesn't matter that wife makes more money than husband. Spousal maintenance is not supposed to be a permanent profit-sharing plan. It's not supposed to equalize incomes. That's not what spousal maintenance is for. You know, in addition, you know, this is not a case where, you know, his skills have become outmoded. The trial court says they haven't. You know, he's employed in his field, working, making good money. Even though the trial court, you know, says it's gone through these factors, its analysis of those factors it shows that it actually wasn't considering them as the statute requires them to be considered.
Ms. Keel, could I ask you a question about the property equalizer issue? You point out, and I don't think it's disputed, that neither party sought that it would be paid in other than pre-tax dollars. Is there something about, I just need to help me understand this issue more from your perspective, because I'm looking at the language in the district court order. Is there something in this order that would prevent the appellant from paying this from pre-tax dollars?
Well, so our position is that the trial court's order is pretty clear that it should be paid pre-tax. The problem is that that's apparently now become a dispute where husband is demanding it to be paid in cash. And that is a very big difference with tax implications. And so to the extent that the court's order can be read as requiring it to be paid in cash, we argue that's error.
But it's not explicitly stated in the order that it be paid in cash.
No, it's not. In fact, it's the property equalizer is, you know, under the heading of retirement accounts, and in the conclusions of law, it's incorporated under the heading of retirement accounts. So the best way to read the court's order is that it be paid pre-tax as the parties had anticipated, and we would ask that be made clear by this court, so that there's the dispute can be resolved and that can get paid with the pre-tax funds.
I'm not sure that I read the district court's order that way. I'm looking at paragraph 52, which talks about retirement accounts. It's an addendum 29. And then it goes through restricted stock units, business interests, stimulus check. Then it talks about debts. And finally, in paragraph 57, it talks about the property equalizer. So I don't necessarily read it under the heading of retirement accounts.
Well, I mean, if you look at how the court has, you know, put headings under throughout the decree, I think it is under the heading of retirement accounts. It's perhaps even more clear when you go to the conclusions of law, where it says conclusion 13, retirement accounts, and it incorporates those paragraphs into there. There is an unfortunate typo as it refers to paragraph 67, but if you look at the conclusions of law as a whole, that has to include the property equalizer, because otherwise the property equalizer is nowhere else to be found in the conclusions of law.
I was going to ask you about the arbitration. I'll just call it the arbitration clause. Everyone agrees that there wasn't an agreement to arbitrate, and so we have this finding of fact that says you have to go to binding arbitration. The conclusion of law says mediation. What do you want us to do about that?
We just want it to be made clear. You know, I think you're right. There's no dispute that the trial court didn't have the authority to order binding arbitration when the parties didn't agree to it. It's in there, in the findings of fact. It would just be easiest for this court to just make that clear in its opinion so that there's no future dispute down the road, and that can get cleaned up.
It sounds like you're asking us to try to clarify what the district court did, which is really the job of the district court. But on the binding arbitration issue, that's in the findings of fact, but it's not in the conclusions of law. And if there is a conflict between the two, the conclusions of law control. So is it really even an issue if it's not in the conclusions of law at all?
Well, I hope that it's not an issue, but given the fact that the history of this case has been, there's been a lot of disagreements, and you know, even on the property equalizer, we thought that there was an agreement that it would be pre-tax, but now there's subsequently been a dispute. I think, you know, it would be worth the time for the court to just make that clear in its opinion that binding arbitration could not have been ordered in this case without an agreement by the parties, just to clarify that mistake. And the case law we've cited to has suggested that it's better to clarify that through appeal than to wait and have to rely on whether finding of fact or conclusion of law governs. You know, a couple more points I'll just point out on the property tax or on the property equalizer. You know, husband's pointed out that we don't know the exact amount of taxes that will be incurred, but we do know that taxes will be incurred if she has to cash that out. That's by statute. We know that she'll have at least a 10% early withdrawal penalty because she's not reached 59.5. And we know that she'll have additional taxes because withdrawals are taxed as ordinary income. So that, you know, all of those taxes are things that the trial court should have considered the tax consequences to the extent that it intended to award it as a cash payment. And those taxes will upset the equitable division of property that the trial court intended to order. And so for those reasons as well, we ask that be reversed to the extent that it's interpreted as a cash payment. If there are no further questions.
I do have one more question. And this goes to the standard of living issue. And you seem to argue in your brief that it should not take into account the party's incomes. But do you have any authority for that position? That seems contrary to the whole idea of determining what the standard of living is.
Well, the standard of living, you know, he has the burden to show what the standard of living is. So the only way that the court can consider the standard of living is for him to show, I need to spend this amount on this, this amount on this, this amount on that. That would equal my standard of living. And so that's what it was.
The standard of living, it looks back to what the standard of living was of the parties, and the district court did do that. Looked at, said that, you know, they were middle income, and this is what they did, and this is how they lived. And that also takes into account what the parties made. But you seem to argue in your brief that the district court erred by taking into account their income. But my question is, what authority do you have? I didn't see any binding authority that says a district court cannot take that into account.
Well, regardless of what the party's income was during the marriage, spousal maintenance is always awarded to meet need. And so it does depend.
That goes back to the first one. I'm talking about the statutory factors, though.
Right, but even in the statutory factors, it's still the same. It's still relevant to the amount and duration. And here, the amount should be zero, or at the very least, less than $2,000 a month. And the duration should certainly not be permanent. And I see that my time has expired. So.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you.
Counsel?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Tim Lees, and I am the attorney for the respondent in this case, Bruce McFarland. And to echo your statements, it's nice to be back in person. You know, we always plan out what we're going to say here, and you've hit a lot of what I was going to address. But, you know, one thing I would note is that a lot of the issues or arguments, especially on the property division, appellant relies on what she thinks the court intended. And, you know, it seems to me that this case begged for a motion for amended findings. Or a new trial, an opportunity to go back to the trial judge where these questions could have been asked. Judge, what was your intent? But we've bypassed that. So, you know, for me, I've got to remember what we're doing here is looking at this in the light most favorable to what the trial court did and what the trial court had before us. And whether we, the lawyers or the judges, think it could have been done differently, or maybe even should have been done differently. The question is, does the evidence support really what the trial court did, or was there a clear abuse of discretion here? The court did not make that express finding as to Mr. McFarland's after-tax net income. And I think the initial brief was kind of opportunistic, trying to take advantage of that omission, just relying on the gross monthly income. And it was very, very carefully stated throughout that brief. They never differentiated between gross and net. But the evidence was there. The court did have that evidence before it, and we submit that by its findings, it's clear that the court considered that evidence.
Well, I appreciate the word you used in your own brief was candor.
Yes.
And you, I'm looking at page 12 and 13, you say you acknowledged that the trial court's failure to make findings as to the party's net income is problematic. And then you go on to acknowledge that under the case of Schmidt v. Schmidt, your argument also is problematic.
It is.
Could you address that, please?
Yeah, and part of that is raised, I argued Walker, which was right at the same time as Schmidt. That one was unpublished with the same issue before us. Obviously, the court, for clarity and for review purposes, should make that finding. But I would submit, you know, we don't have a case where we have a difficult net income to calculate. We're not dealing with a self-employed individual. that maybe we're looking at business expenses versus personal expenses in finding net monthly income. We're dealing with a W-2 employee. And even counsel in their brief, as Judge Reyes pointed out, concedes that, well, his net income from his regular pay stub is $4,022 a month. And Jennifer Leffler's calculations was $3,927 a month. So we've got a range there of the evidence of $95. And the appellant didn't put any evidence suggesting that the net income was otherwise. They may have argued it was otherwise, but there was no evidence suggesting it was otherwise. And in Schreifels versus Schreifels, 450 Northwest 2nd, 372, what the court said was an income determination needs only to be within a reasonable range of figures. Well, if the only evidence before the court was this reasonable range within $95, I think in this case, it's not a reversible error. Well, the court perhaps...
The judge in the findings of fact did find that your client's monthly income was $600-some and monthly expenses was $55. And said that he could meet his needs. That was a finding.
Right, and I'd like to address that finding. I don't read that in the way that counsel suggests. And again, when we're reading these things, we've got to read this judgment decree as a whole. And there is an order in which the court made findings of fact. And prior to its findings of fact on the spousal maintenance, it did its whole child support analysis. And as part of that analysis, the court determined each party's incomes to put into the child support calculator. Those are their incomes. And it, in that analysis above the maintenance findings, it included the $2,000 in spousal maintenance in Mr. McFarland's income, and it deducted that $2,000 in maintenance from the appellant's income. And so therefore, the court had found what their incomes were. So I think when we get to that finding, and again, I concede the ambiguity in that finding. It was strange the first time I read it as well, because it was inconsistent with everything else in the maintenance findings. But in my mind, I think the reasonable interpretation is, well, the court had already found that he was getting that $2,000 a month maintenance in its establishment of their income for child support purposes. And so when it says, you know, prospectively they're going to be able to meet their expenses with their incomes, the court had already determined that that $2,000 was going to be in that income. You'll note the court didn't say they're able to meet their expenses with their employment income or their income from employment. It said their income. So I would submit that that's the correct interpretation of that. But again, it goes back to the notion that, look, however you calculate the net income in this case, and between the evidence, the proposed findings submitted to the court, the income numbers used in the reply brief, every one of those, the net income is less than his expenses. So to say there is no need, it isn't an intellectually or factually sound statement to make. There is need here.
What about going forward, Mr. Lees? If this court, and I have no idea how we are going to ultimately rule on this matter, but if the maintenance award is affirmed, it seems that this is a case that will be subject to subsequent challenge as your client's income increases. And isn't there a need to have a finding of net income at this point that a future decision could be based on?
Well, I think it would be helpful. Is it needed? I think the same arguments that are being made here today are going to be made at that time. And that may not be the cleanest way to do things, but what may or may not be helpful in the future, are we going to reverse based on that, I guess is the question I would have.
As a follow-up to Judge Hallbrook's question, Permanent maintenance seems a stretch here, since your client is in his 40s, healthy, working in the field for which he trained, earning a good income. So why should it be permanent?
Well, but a party can be healthy. They can be working full-time. They can be making, they can be working in the industry that they've been trained for. But that doesn't mean that that profession or what they're doing, that doesn't necessarily translate to, well, that provides enough income then to meet your monthly expenses when we're looking at how the folks lived during the marriage. Again, we get back to that standard of living. But on the permanent award, we've got to remember that in the vernacular of spousal maintenance, permanent doesn't mean forever. And the law is very clear on that. What permanent means is it's open-ended, and it can be modified or eliminated when there's a significant or substantial change in circumstances. So if appellant's predictions come true, and at some point in the future, Mr. McFarland will be earning enough to cover his expenses, she has a remedy. But the point is, in the statutory scheme and the case law is, under the facts of this case, the court can't know that that's going to happen. The court can't know when that might happen, when somehow, you know, there was no testimony as what the trajectory of his, or evidence as the trajectory of his income. So they can't know when or if that's going to happen, where his income is now exceeding his expenses. So that, by definition, is uncertainty. And that uncertainty is exactly what the statute addresses. When there's uncertainty, make it permanent. I like to use the word open-ended, but the legislature chose permanent. And I think the court was well within its discretion to do that. I don't want to direct away from this, but I do want to address this property division issue, and I see my yellow light's on. Is it all right if I move on to that briefly?
Right, you still have over 4.5 minutes.
Okay,
left.
I see the timer now. You know, one thing that came up was standard of living, and, you know, that's always going to be a very difficult thing to quantify, right? Some of it, I think, is the overall impression that these district court judges draw from these from these trials. In our case, it was 2 years of two days of trial, hearing testimony about a 22-year marriage, and where the parties lived, what their house was like, what kind of activities they did, and what things they provided for their kids, what kind of cars they drove. And in this case, really the standard of living, kind of the main thing in your life is your home. And these guys lived in a nice $730,000 home in Edina, which I think we can all concede is a fairly wealthy community. They could have Mr. McFarland home as a stay-at-home parent. They purchased and built new houses throughout the marriage. They didn't carry debt. They traveled. They owned cars, and they didn't have car payments. So can we define some quantifiable measure of standard of living? I don't think we'll ever be able to do that. But what the court heard, the evidence the court heard about all these things, and what the evidence the court considered are in its findings of fact and how it concluded this matter should be resolved on the spousal maintenance front.
Counsel, I'd like to ask about I want to go back to the Schmidt case, because I'm struggling as to why we shouldn't just reverse and remand back to the district court to clarify, first and foremost, the lack of a finding on net income. But it seems like there are other issues that might need to be clarified as well. Why shouldn't we do that?
Because of the tight range of net income evidence there was on the record. Again, we're not talking about a big swing where, boy, if the court would have found this way, that would have eliminated the maintenance question. If the court had found this way, well, it certainly supports Mr. McFarland. Again, we're talking about a $95 range there. I know Schmidt, I don't know if I've completely thought through the relevance of this, but Schmidt was just a flat-out denial of spousal maintenance by the court based on a gross income number. And I believe in Schmidt there were more complicating factors with regard to the income and what comprised the income. Here we have a W-2 employee and with a very tight range between $3,900 and $4,000 some in net income. So I don't think it does this case a service to remand. I think the court can find that the evidence was there and that it was adequately considered when the court applied the statutory scheme in determining the spousal maintenance.
And do you agree with Ms. Keel about the arbitration, how we should deal with that?
Yeah, I think it's a non-issue. But as long as we're here, again, another thing that begged for a motion for amended findings. That could have been resolved like that. And we've never contested that was inappropriately in there. Judge Flaskamp, just to touch on a question you had, what's the big deal about awarding pre-tax versus after-tax? Well, if what the proposal is that they transfer $55,000 from her employment or from her retirement to him, then for him to access that money, he's got to cash it out. There's going to be a 10% penalty, and there's going to be federal and state income taxes, so he's going to maybe get two-thirds of the dollar there. But again, the court made a global division of the assets in this case versus dividing assets in kind. And even with counsel's argument, they don't make a distinction between the pre-tax retirement and the after-tax retirement. None of the math adds up here as far as what they're proposing. And if the court had wanted that transferred with retirement funds, it would have included the standard language that it be transferred by qualified domestic relations order, would have said who had to draft that qualified domestic relations order, who would pay the fees for it. This was not an order that retirement funds be transferred.
But at
it's
the same time,
$55,000.
But at the same time, the district court never said this is should be transferred by cash.
But the court didn't say it should be transferred by giving her car to him either.
So why isn't it in her discretion as to how that transfer should occur?
She can do it however she wants. If she wants to cash out the retirement and pay him $55,000, but at the end of the day, he has to have a check or whatever for $55,000. And by transferring the retirement funds, he doesn't get that. He gets $55,000 less 10%, less in order to access those funds and pay taxes, he's going to get, again, maybe two-thirds to 50 cents on the dollar for that.
Or just keep that money in the retirement fund and let it grow.
Well, but again, nothing, we can't require him what to do with that money. He's entitled to $55,000. And he's the one that's in the tougher financial position in this matter, and he should be able to use that money at his discretion, unless it was specifically ordered, which it was not. So again, rather than
didn't he get a half of the sale of the house though? It was $730,000.
Yes, he did.
Okay, so
but that doesn't obviate the fact that the court said he was supposed to receive $55,000 as equalizer.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Ms. Keel, any rebuttal?
Yes. Thank you. First, I want to address the question about the permanency of the spousal maintenance award. And, it's very rare for somebody in their 40s to be granted permanent spousal maintenance when they're healthy, they're in their field. All of these circumstances. And husband points to, when there's uncertainty, maybe it should be permanent, but that's uncertainty as to if the spouse will ever be able to provide for their own needs, not when. And so here, under the numbers that we've proposed, there is no uncertainty. He's already meeting his needs, and so certainly a permanent award would not be appropriate in these circumstances.
Your position is difficult because of our standard of review being, abuse of discretion, unless there's some error in the way the district court approached the statutory analysis.
it's true that the standard of review is abuse of discretion, but under these facts, I think, you know, it's so unusual to have someone in their 40s getting permanent maintenance when, as I said, if you go through the factors, it really does look like the court is continually going back to the fact that wife makes more money than husband. And that's not, you know, the purpose of spousal maintenance is not to equalize incomes.
But we have to view the evidence in the light most favorable to the district court's decision. And your characterization of it seems contrary to that admonition that we need to follow.
No, I mean, even looking at it in the light most favorable, the numbers are the numbers, and the court had an obligation to, you know, consider the things that we've pointed out, that the car payment should not have been included, that the child support certainly should not have been included. These are clear things that, you know, the numbers are what they are, and so, you know, even in the light most favorable, there has been an abuse of discretion.
Why wasn't there a motion for amended findings made?
So I did want to respond to that. So
I don't know if that's part of the record, but I can't help but.
So for the property equalizer, it wasn't clear that there was going to be a dispute about this until after the time for amended findings had passed, because wife was operating under the assumption, in accordance with the party's submissions, that everybody agreed it would be from the retirement accounts. And for the spousal maintenance, we didn't need an amended findings because under the numbers that the trial court used, with the 6,000 and some income and the 5,000 some in expenses.
Right, but that was based on gross income, though, and it's well settled that we look at net income.
Well, that's the reason the amended findings motion wasn't made. You know, in hindsight, who knows? But the fact of the matter is we're here now, and these are things that this court can look at it and see the error, and it would be appropriate to reverse on those issues. I just wanted to touch briefly on the argument that the trial court, in stating that parties were able to meet their expenses with their incomes, was somehow including the spousal maintenance payment in that. I don't think that makes a lot of sense, since the court is trying to decide whether to grant spousal maintenance at that point. To argue that it was somehow assuming that it already had granted that maintenance when saying that the parties are able to meet their expenses, I don't think that's a reasonable reading of the judgment and decree as a whole. So I don't think that argument should go very far. And then I think just in general, again, these three issues that we've raised are fairly clear on the spousal maintenance. You know, and even if not all of the arguments are persuasive to the court, certainly the amount of maintenance here is excessive under various different ways that you run the numbers. He certainly doesn't have a $2,000 a month deficit, and it certainly shouldn't be permanent. And again, to the equalizer, all indications were that it would be from the retirement funds. And so to the extent there's any uncertainty in how to read the court's order, that should be made clear as well. And again, I don't think the arbitration is that big of an issue, but could be clarified as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Case is well briefed and well argued, and we'll have our decision out within the 90 days. We're allowed.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think the attorneys are here for our